This is Gary Parr, and before we start this week's Fiber Talk podcast, I want to welcome our new sponsor, Fat Quarter Shop. Fat Quarter Shop started as an online quilting shop that is expanding into cross-stitch. They stock DMC, Classic Colorworks, and Weeks Dye Works threads, along with a variety of cross-stitch ground cloth. You'll also find patterns from popular designers such as Country Cottage Needleworks, Little House Needleworks, Hands-On Design, Tiny Modernist, and Heart in Hand Needle Art. Fat Quarter Shop is also working with Priscilla Blaine and Chelsea Carter of the Real Housewives of Cross-Stitch to create t-shirts, tote bags, and thread packs. If you want to build your stash or want to try something new, Fat Quarter Shop offers monthly subscription clubs for Witch Elt Neutral 14-Count Aida, Witch Elt Neutral 28-Count Linen, Chalk Full Cross-Stitch, and Classic Colorworks Floss Fix. This June, join Kimberly Jolly for a stitch-along with Lori Holt's latest design, So She Did. Kimberly will be stitching on Fat Quarter Shop's Floss Tube channel Wednesdays at 9 a.m. Central Standard Time. Visit Fat Quarter Shop at fatquartershop.com. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr, and you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for people who do fine art with needle and thread. And this week, my guest, Pat Goodson. Hi, Pat.
Hey. How are you doing, Gary?
I'm going to be all right. Now, Pat, we run into because Pat did a model for Arlene Cohen.
Correct.
And so then we had an exchange because last time Arlene and I talked, just because I was glancing through notes, I had you moved to Irving, Texas, as opposed to where you live. And so you wrote to kindly correct me on that. You don't live in Irving, but you're a professor at Texas A&M and do needlework. And you did how many models for Arlene? Just one, two?
Oh, I just did one as a gift for her. It wasn't really a model in the sense. I didn't intend it to be a model. I just love her design, so I made one and sent it to her as a gift.
Oh, well, there we go. So then, in the exchanges, it just became obvious that I needed to talk to Pat about her stitching. So here we are. Yay.
Oh, thank you. Yep. Let me start by saying thank you for having me on this. I don't think you have an idea of how important this podcast is and how it brings everything together in the floss tube world. And I'm also like a little bit starstruck to be here because it's like when you go through your website and you see all the guests that you've invited and they're all like, you know, Royal School of Needle Art, Needlework instructors and graduates and owners of businesses and designers. And I'm going, I don't do any of that. So how come I'm here? So feeling a little bit out of my league here, but really grateful that I'm doing this. So thank you.
Not at all. You're here because you have the same disease I have.
Yes.
And that is, you got to try all of the things.
Yes, all of the things.
Yes, because we look here at the list, hardanger, cross-stitch, bobbin lace, needle lace, Irish crochet, filet crochet. We got to hear about these things.
See, and I forgot to add tatting. I should have added tatting to that one.
Geez, see, so that's why we have to talk. Is we have to learn about these things. So
yeah, but you got to remember, I'm still a student of all things. You know, I do all things, but I'm still a student of all things. So I'm just happy to share some things I learned. But I am so grateful again for FlossTube and your podcast because boy, have I learned stuff. By the way, not just learned but been enabled. Right. So this week's midweek podcast with Vanna. When you talk about Kay's creation stands, guess what I did right in the middle of the podcast?
Oh, there we go.
Yeah. So, and then later I sent them an email saying, oh, by the way, as you're processing my purchase, just want to let you know I heard about you on Fiber Talk. And they wrote back and said, oh, thank you so much for letting us know. We love the mention. So,
yeah. Okay. Somebody wrote in the other day, we have a new hashtag, and I'm going to get this wrong because I didn't write it down, but the new hashtag, Fiber Talk made me buy it.
Yes.
Yeah, so there we go.
Yeah.
That's our new new hashtag we're going to use.
Absolutely. But I consider the work you do a little bit more than just that enabling. So, yeah, but it does happen once in a while.
Well, I'm glad you bought the case creation stand. I think you're going to like it.
Yes, and I bought it because I need an alternative to my standing up stitching setup. I need one for sitting down, and I didn't have one. And I was looking at a Lowry frame, mm-hmm. but then I looked at it and compared it to Kay's creation, and I thought, no, Kay's has a few features, like the ability to adjust the height exactly like you want it, whereas the Lowry has set points for adjustment in the height. And okay. So going, okay, that might be better for me. It might work better for me.
Yeah, so. Well, let's talk about that, because we've had conversations in recent podcasts about the standing up stitching thing, because I really think that's something people need to look into, and I haven't gotten around to it, but I am going to look into it myself. And yes, the case creation, because it's just a clamp on a steel post that you mm-hmm. can put at any height, really does lend itself to that kind of a thing. But you, what is your setup for stand-up stitching?
Well, I use what's called a daylight stand, floor stand, that mm-hmm. adjusts in height. And it's a very simple, one pole, two U-shaped legs, and one clamp that swivels 360. And when I have it set up all the way, the central post all the way down and put it on top of my dining room table, it has the exact perfect height for me to clamp on a Q-snap frame. And then on the side of that table, I have a Britech adjustable arm clamp light with magnifier mm-hmm. on top of it. And I set it up there. It's the exact height I need. And it's always set up, Gary. For me, that was a game changer, to have something I could leave it up all the time. And if I have time to come and just put in two stitches, it's better than nothing, right? But right. before, it was like, oh my gosh, I have to get everything out of the closet, unbundle everything, yep. get it up, you know, like you and Vanna were talking last time about getting into the chair with the big, with the big frames and stuff. And it was so much work that I wouldn't do it. But once I set it up and left it there, I don't have anybody that will mess with it or pets or anything. I can leave it there. I'm brewing my coffee. I have to wait a few seconds, and I don't want to unload the dishwasher while I do that. I'll just go do two or three stitches on this humongous piece I'm working on. So it from that perspective also, not just from the ergonomics of it, but also from the practicality of having it always set up, always ready to go.
Yeah, and see, that's the thing. Well, set that aside. Let's get back to the stand-up. So you decided to try that because you at work there at the university had encountered some adjustable height desks for standing up.
Correct. So in my department, I was the first one actually to start using a stand-up desk. And I did it because I was hearing from my friends in the School of Public Health who were doing a lot of research about using stand-up desks in schools with kids, because kids learn better when they are learning in movement, when they're moving around many times. And so they were doing studies on that and showing really good results. And I'm thinking, well, if it works for the kids, right, wouldn't it work for me? Because the issue is my work is very sedentary. And I, you know, if I'm not standing up, I'm sitting down for 10, sometimes 12 hours a day. And at the end of the day, I feel like I've been run over by a 10-ton truck. And I've just sat down. I haven't done anything physically. And so I said, I'm going to try it. So I went to my department head and I said, what this very desk adjustable platform that you put on top of your desk. And he said, okay, can you get me a doctor's note recommendation for this? Otherwise, I can't justify the purchase. I said, sure, my chiropractor will be more than happy to give me that recommendation. And she did, and I got the thing. And now, Gary, if you come to my department, almost every office has a very desk with people standing up. And I found out that in a 12-hour day or a 10-hour day, if I alternated between standing up and sitting down, like every hour or so, switching the positions, I would get to the end of the day tired, but not feeling run over by a 10-ton truck. It was a different kind of tired. So then I started thinking, well, stitching is such a sedentary thing.
Let me back you up there. So, sure. Because I tried the stand-up desk for a while, mm-hmm. and because I have the same kind of sedentary job all day long in a chair staring at a computer screen. Right. And it worked some days, and I just tried it for short periods of time. But when I had to do a lot of typing, I had to sit down. Mm-hmm. And mine was kind of a makeshift setup, so I didn't have the ability to easily adjust. So I just had to tear it down because I couldn't. But mm-hmm. So this Vera desk that you have, it's a motorized desk that you're able to just move up and down.
No, it's not a motorized desk. It's okay. A platform, like a big tray that has a hydraulic system and places where you hold onto the sides and you just press a little lever on each side and you very easily raise it or lower it on top of your desk. And it has your computer on it and okay. your screen, monitor, and your keyboard, et cetera. And it's very easy to move up and down.
And see, that's to me, that was the key because I did not have that as an option.
Correct. So before I bought this and really decided to ask to get one at my department, I tried with books. I tried it with, you know, piling up books to see how I would feel by doing that. And it looked good, but I had the same problem. I had to alternate. I had to switch periodically and often to make it feel good. Yeah. So, and I didn't want, you know, the motorized desks themselves are like thousands of dollars, right. really expensive. And I'm going, but I don't need that. I can do the platform up and down and much cheaper, easy. I thought I was afraid it was going to be too heavy to move it. It's not. It has a very smooth hydraulic system. It works wonderfully. Now, the problem that happens now is that I'll start writing standing up or working in the morning, and sometimes I forget to sit down. I'll just go, and then all of a sudden I'm going, I'm feeling kind of tired. Why is it? And I'm going, oh, I've been standing for 3 hours nonstop.
So you've gotten yourself over that hump
yeah.
of standing up for an extended period of time to the point yeah. where now you don't even think about it.
Nope. And I miss it. If I'm sitting all day, I really miss it. So I've made it a habit. I'm in a lot of meetings, for instance. And if I have some meetings that go 3 or 4 hours, I will stand up in the middle of the meeting. And I'll stand up at the back of the room and I'll pace around or just stand up. And I warned them beforehand, I am going to be standing up. So I'm not sitting all the time. So, yeah. And I've learned to do my writing and thinking. I have a colleague of mine that one day came to my office and I was writing standing up. He said, Pat, I see you do some of your work standing up, but you don't do your serious writing standing up, do you? And I said, well, define serious writing, first of all. But yeah, I do. I've written books. I write journal articles and all of that, partially standing up. And it really helps for me. It was a game changer. And so I said, it has to be helpful for the stitching because stitching, you know, I may stand up in the office, but then I go home and then I'm going to spend several hours sitting down again all the time with the stitching. And on weekends, if I can stitch all weekend, yay. But I'm sitting down. That's not as good. So when I came up with the stand-up alternative, it was wonderful for me.
So, all right. So you have this setup on your dining room table. And now you know, I've talked about the old bar trick where there's a rail underneath the bar to put your foot up on. Do you have something that you put a foot yes. up on that you can shift weight? Do you have a yes. little stool you lean against? How do you work it?
I have, do you know those little shelf things that Rubbermaid makes to put on your kitchen cabinets to stack dishes on so you can have a tiny little shelf inside of a shelf?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
Those are wire and they're very light. And I have one that's about maybe 10 by 6 or something like that in size. And because it's very light, that's what I use. I alternate one foot on top of that every few minutes and I switch around. I like it because it's light enough that I can move the position, change the position of that thing mm-hmm. and put it from one side to another or adjust it somewhat because it's very light and I can do it with my foot. But yes, that helps because, and that was my chiropractor's advice was if you're going to do this, you want to have one foot propped up a little bit. Doesn't have, so it's about not more than 5 inches tall away from the ground. She says, just that little bit of lift of one leg and bending of one knee will help align your entire spinal cord and column, right? Your back gets
so
that, really...
Oh, so that's the function, that's the physical function it provides, is an alignment. So that allows you to be more comfortable.
Yeah, and it feels like it's more restful.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then you just switch back and forth according to how you feel.
Switch back and forth, and it's really light to kick around. I know that when you talked to Arlene about this, Arlene said, maybe you could do it with books. And I say, yes, you can, but then you can't move it around the book as easily. The books will tend to stay in one place, in one position. And this one, you can put it on your right side or on your left side, or, you know, swivel a little bit, however you want it.
Yeah. Now, when you... Sorry, a ton of questions in this area. But sure. When you're stitching standing up, now let me back up. So when I stitch, I have an office chair with arms, and adjustable arms, and I have them at two different heights because I stitch two-handed. So mm-hmm. I keep my forearms rested on those things, and I can just go on for hours. When you stand up, you don't have that support.
Correct.
So was there an adjustment there in terms of arm and shoulder strength as you worked your way through it?
I never felt a problem with that.
Okay.
Because I don't have anywhere where to rest the weight of my arms, but the Q-snap frame that I have, and because I do two-handed also, it functions sort of as a semi-resting point for one of my arms, the one that's on top of the frame.
Mm-hmm.
I don't lean on it. I don't put the weight of my arm on it, but it's sort of like a reference point. And I kind of touch my arm on the Q-snap on the side if I need to rest. But I feel most of the time I'm not doing that. I'm just stitching away. And I don't know what it is, Gary. There's a balance to the whole thing somehow that I don't feel as tired. But I can't do 3 or 4 hours in a row without breaks. So the other part of this system is alternating, standing and sitting once in a while. But if you're just going to stand for long periods of time, taking breaks and getting completely away from that for at least 5 minutes, do something else, rest your arms and come back if needed, not staying with it for very, very long periods of time. Then you work yourself into exhaustion, and that's not fun.
Right. Well, see, and that's, to me, that's the key. I hear stories all the time about people who are able to stitch for long periods of time, and ankles swell, shoulders get sore, arms get sore, and so on and so forth. And that my first thing I think of is, during those 3 or 4 hours, did you ever get up? Did you ever mm-hmm. move around and make that yeah. blood flow through your body? And my guess is, in most instances, the answer is no.
Right.
Yeah. And that's just physically a key thing.
Absolutely is. So I teach academic writing and writing productivity. And one of the things that's key for writing productivity is to do it in small chunks of time with lots of little mini breaks in between. So when we have a writing group, when we write together, we do 20 minutes on task, 5 minutes break, 20 minutes on task, 5 minutes break. And then during those 5 minutes, if we're sitting down, we move around, we stand up. If we're standing up, we sit down. We try to do something completely physically, completely different during those 5 minutes. And what also happens is something interesting, too. Every time you interrupt and then you come back, at least for the writing, and I'm sure for the stitching, too, you reset your attention. So if you stay with a task too long in what we call binge writing or binge stitching, if you stay with a task too long, you start to lose concentration. You start to get mentally fatigued after a while. You don't notice it. You only notice it when you're way past the comfortable zone and you go, oh, now I'm tired. But with writing, for instance, if you write for a bit, take a break and come back, what you're doing is you're resetting your attention up to a high level. And when it starts dropping a bit, you break it and then you reset and start again. So for writing, it works beautifully. And I would venture to say that for stitching, especially complex projects, it would too.
Okay, so now, all right, now we're going right down the rabbit hole here, because see, that speaks to me in the one of the magazines I edit is for architecture, and we talk about biophilia, mm-hmm. which is, you know, the, I think it's Japanese, certainly Asian, but I think it's Japanese principle of connecting with nature, mm-hmm. and how you take a little walk outside just to connect with nature, and it refreshes that mind and puts you back. Mm-hmm. Helps you refocus the very thing you described.
Yes.
And so that, all right, so this all comes together. It always comes back to those kinds of things.
It does. And it also avoids that freezing your muscles in a certain position. So even for writers, if you stay with a writing project 2 or 3 hours, what happens is you're blinking less because you're staring at a screen. You're freezing your muscles in certain positions because you're not moving around. And that's what happens with the stitching too. And eventually the accumulation of that over time leads to, you know, inflammation, pain, dry eye, sore back. Oh, you name it. You got it.
To work on standing up and stitching, there are clearly many more benefits than just standing up. There's a lot more to this. And if you mix that with breaks, mm-hmm. you're going to be probably make fewer mistakes.
I would say,
do a better job all the way around, enjoy it more, and walk away from it without aches and pains.
Yeah, and somehow you feel like you've done a lot of work and you feel refreshed. And you know, when I talk about the writing thing, and I bet this would apply to the stitching too, if you tell me you wrote for 2 hours nonstop, I can almost bet my salary on the fact that the bulk of the real writing and the most productive part was like that first half hour.
Uh-huh.
Then the rest is going to be you going downhill on your attention and your focus and your freshness and your creativity. But when you start to come down on that and you break it and you refresh and you connect with nature. And I tell my students, I said, go walk around the block. You know, go lift weights, put some weights on next to your chair, lift weights, do something completely different. Come back, you're reset and your focus and your attention is fully on it. So if you do 5 rounds of 20 minutes, they will be 20 minutes that are fully engaged versus 2 hours of maybe half an hour engaged and then the rest fooling yourself, maybe.
Yeah, so then from a stitching perspective, then you're going to have 5 hours, 20 minutes at a time, but
correct.
Chances are that you'll have not missed a stitch or missed fewer stitches. Your tension will be better. Yeah, okay.
And when you're trying to do something like that by, you know, stitching, sitting down, I can see Vanna getting into her easy chair like she was described. And trying to do that every 20 minutes, you wouldn't do it because it's such a hassle that you go, oh, no, I'm not going to get up for 5 minutes and come back. This is so complicated to get set up. So that doesn't work. But if it's the standing thing and all you have to do is walk away,
right.
It's easier.
Well, see, that was the thing. That was the thing that why I wanted to set that aside and come back to it. And you've done a beautiful job of segueing to that is that very thing. Because now I'm picturing you're set up at your dining room table. And like you said, you're waiting for the coffee to make. You can just walk over there and do a couple stitches and then walk back and get your coffee. So through the day, you can knock off little sessions all day long.
Correct.
Really with zero effort.
Correct. And then you, at the end of the day, you look at your stitching and you say, wow, all of a sudden there's a 10 by 10 square here that's complete. When did I do that?
Yes.
Yeah. And I go, oh, well, I guess I did it, you know, broken up in little things. And sometimes it's just enough time, for instance, to, you know, if I have something on the stove, it's time enough to thread a needle for the next stitch. And that's enough. That's progress already.
Right. Right. Oh, well, that's, you know, that's been one of my, I really wish I remember who told me about it, but one of my techniques anymore is I never leave my stitching session without the next thread started.
Yes.
So I could,
you're like Hemingway, who would write a sentence and leave a sentence midway to complete tomorrow when he came back to writing.
Oh, I didn't know he did that. Okay.
Yeah. So that's the idea. And I will do that too. Sometimes I'll leave a stitch half stitched.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. If I'm doing cross stitch, that's exactly how I leave it. I'll bring the needle up. So one leg is done. And then when I come back the next day, all I do is plunge that needle and keep going. Yep.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now there are a couple I have not tried doing standing up. One of them is knitting, and I don't do a lot of knitting anyway. And some crochet pieces I might be able to do standing up, and tatting also. But I tend to do my crochet sitting down most of the time. I think it has to do with the weight of the fabric that I'm creating.
Yeah.
And it's not as comfortable to do it standing up unless I have a place to lay it on while I'm standing up.
Yeah, well, I could see that because if you're doing a blanket or something, the weight of that, plus I got to believe it would be difficult to keep the tension consistent if it's constantly pulling down on you.
Correct.
Yeah. So a limitation there.
Yes.
Ooh, I'm learning things. See, you wondered why. Now this is why, right here, that we are talking. See, we're learning things.
Well, I'm always trying to learn some stuff. And boy, have I learned through the FlossTube community. And, you know, I don't have a presence. I don't comment on anybody's videos. But I know everybody and I know their work. And I've learned so much from each of them. It's amazing. So.
Yeah, there's a lot to learn. All right, so now the other thing I'm curious about with you is you started your stitching in Brazil. That's where you learned. Tell about that, because I'm always curious, different parts of the world, what needlework is like.
Right, so I'm a missionary kid, and my father's American. My mother was Portuguese, and my father went to Brazil as a missionary, met my mom, who was his language teacher, and I was born in Brazil. I was born and raised in Brazil. So until recently, I could claim that I lived half of my life in Brazil and half here. Now it's going to a little bit over half here now. But
time will do that, yes.
Absolutely. So I really had the Brazilian Portuguese side of my family. I had a grandmother who did all things related to needle crafts. My mother sewed. She was a great seamstress. And I had a couple of aunts that did some really beautiful artwork with knitting and crochet and embroidery. So I learned very early on. And one thing I recalled yesterday, I hadn't thought about this in 50 years. I remember that when I was in 5th grade, I was 11 years old. I was doing cut work. We had home ec courses, and I think the teacher saw that I was more familiar with sewing and embroidery than most of the kids in the class. And she challenged me to do, you know how you can do a little hem or a seam on a garment where you remove a few threads and then you just go around sewing that seam, but you're pulling the remaining threads in little patterns. I was doing that when I was 11. And I'm going, oh my goodness, I totally forgot that. So I was brought up in a family that had a lot of interest related to that. And I learned things very different way because of that, Gary. Mm-hmm. So knitting, for instance, when I learned that Americans knitted in a completely different way than we did, it was very interesting because we learned the continental way of knitting. And even the way I crochet and I hold the crochet hook and the thread is different from a lot of the American counterparts that I've seen crocheting. So there are differences in techniques and in ways of doing certain things.
So when you learned to do any kind of needlework when you were a child then, you were learning from grandmother formal sit-down sessions or just part of normal day of life? Just
a lot of it was just by observing.
Okay.
And on my own, but then I would go to them for help and specific instruction. And fortunately, I had people that instructed me that were not afraid of starting over ever. And I can't, you know, I just it breaks my heart when I remember these things. I would do swatches of crochet or of knitting and show them to my grandmother or one of my aunts, and she would say, oh, there's a mistake down here, 15 rows below. Rip, 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 pull, pull.
Oh, no.
Start over again, you know? So, yeah, so that was a good part. It was a painful part, but it was a good part of my training. But so I would go to them to learn specific things that I wanted to learn. One of the things I never learned was Brazilian embroidery. Nordic Needle, for instance, has several examples of Brazilian embroidery and kits and stuff. And it uses this very silky but very slippery thread for doing lots of bullion stitches. And that was something that nobody knew exactly how to teach me how to do that. So I never learned that.
Hmm.
And tatting was something that I always wanted to learn, but I never saw anybody doing it. But my mother had in one of her drawers had two little shuttles hidden away. And I always remember asking my mother, what are these? And she would say, oh, it's something for doing needlework that your grandmother has. And nobody ever explained it. I never saw anybody using it, but I was intrigued by the two little shuttles. What are they for? What do they do? But only after I moved to the United States as an adult was when I started teaching myself tatting. And I went on the internet at a time when the internet didn't have videos. So they were static explanations of tatting, which is interesting because tatting has a little twist there that you need to see it being done. So, so it was mostly, I would be motivated to learn something and I'd go after it with my aunts. They weren't after me to try to teach everything they knew. No, I was a nuisance to them probably.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. I just always intrigued by the dynamic there. Yeah. So you were that little kid, show me, show me, show me. Okay.
Yes. Yes. And then they would show me and I'd go, oh no, that's too hard. I don't want to do that. I was kind of lazy too. So.
Oh, well, hey.
Yeah.
We were all kids at one time. We got to do those things. Yep. So with the cut work, then you got over that hump when it comes to hardanger. You got over that hump early on. That's usually the biggest leap for people is cutting that ground cloth. So that was a non-issue for you early on.
That always strikes me as fascinating because hardanger, I always tell people, if you know how to count to five, I can teach you how to do hardanger.
Right. Yeah.
I cannot teach you how to count to five, but if you can, I will teach you hardanger. It's so easy. And then when I hear people talking about, oh, it's so intimidating, the cutting, and I'm going, it's just cutting. I mean, I don't see the intimidation part at all. Now, granted, I have to be able to see very well what I'm doing and have very sharp or appropriate tools and scissors that are sharp enough and all that sort of stuff. But no, I was never intimidated by it. And hardanger, I find, is one of the easiest forms of embroidery out there.
Yeah, that's interesting. Easiest. I mean, I enjoy it. I don't find it hard. But I guess, yeah, there really is. Once you get cluster blocks down and get the threads cut and pulled, so much of it is just wrapping.
Yep. And satin stitching.
Yep. Now you make me think about it. Yeah, that's really all there's to it.
You can count to four and to five, basically. You can do it. I find it very, very one of the simplest forms of work. And interestingly enough, that one I can't do standing up because I don't do hardanger on frames or hoops. I stitch in hand on the hardanger.
Now that's interesting because I would think you would immediately go to some kind of support to keep the ground cloth firm.
Nope. I don't. Don't ask me why. I have no idea.
Okay. That's interesting. All right. All right. Do you do much hardanger? Is that something you do a lot of? Is that?
I don't do a whole lot of it. I wish I did more actually, but, I do enough. I love the hardanger, but it's easy, but it takes a long time. I do try to do smaller pieces and give them away as gifts just to satisfy, because sometimes I'm doing a lot of cross stitch and I go, oh, I miss hardanger so much. And then I need to go and do a project. And then I start working on that and I go, okay, met that need. Now let me go back to the other.
Yeah, now I've all only ever done small hardanger, and mm-hmm. and I enjoy it, but I've never tackled a bigger project. And but oh boy, when you see one, a larger one, an Yvette Stanton one, they're just stunning. They're just beautiful.
Stunning, exactly. And they look like they're so difficult, and they're not. So
yeah, just persistence.
Yeah, you're gonna face some hardanger on the Queen Sampler, right?
Oh yeah, yep. Yeah, we're freaking Vaughn out with that.
Yeah, so it's very the influence thing about your podcast, for instance. I'm not a sampler person at all because samplers are not part of the Brazilian tradition. They're just not, like quilting is not part of the Brazilian tradition either. And so when I get to the United States to live this time, I see all of these samplers and people so passionate about samplers and such a big deal. And I'm going, what's the big deal? I don't understand it. I think they're pretty, but I wouldn't want to stitch one of them. But then when you and Vaughn start talking about, you know, how you're going to have the Vaughn team and the Gary team, and you're going to do the Queen Sampler, and you're doing the Sarah Brazier, and I'm going, geez, I am getting tempted to do a sampler. What the heck is going on?
Well, it's a very, because I'm a needle pointer. You know, that's uh-huh. what I learned. I'm a needle pointer. And you know, you talk about, I need to try a little hard on her. As a matter of fact, I've been working on this Sarah Brazier now for several weeks. And I got to go back and do some needle point. I just have to. And that's probably going to happen in the next few days here. One of the needle point projects is coming out. Because I just got to get back to that, working on the canvas and mm-hmm. and doing the various stitches. And because I need a little break from all the little X's. But the samplers, and I'm a recent convert to these things. Mm-hmm. And it to me, it's fun in the way that it's so much fun to do a motif and you get these intermediate senses of accomplishment.
Yes, I see that. I can see that.
Yeah.
But then these things you're working on are so big. I'm going, what am I going to do with that after I finish it?
Yeah, there is that, isn't there?
Yes.
But fortunately, there are smaller versions of these things. But true. Yeah, Sarah Brazier at 30 inches wide is, I have no idea what I'm going to do with it, but I'm finishing it one way or another. And I'm finishing it before Vaughn, too. So.
Okay, so I'll be rooting for you, Gary, here.
Yeah, join my team, too, please. Her team is massive. I'm a pretty small group here, so.
No, I'll be on your team, but I'll, you know, kind of root for her once in a while, too. But, you know, I'm one to say I'm doing a Heaven and Earth design. And
oh, so well, what are you talking about then? Because well, those not... I don't get. That I don't get those. I can't even think about doing one of those. Wow.
Well, it's all the Floss Tube community's fault. Because I, until 3 years ago, I was, you know, my world of cross stitch was the smaller pieces. And I even did miniature cross stitch, like pieces that are 1 inch by 1 inch type thing. And so I start watching these Floss Tube videos and people doing these full coverage designs. And I'm going, oh my goodness, can I do that? Would I be able to do that? So it was more of a test. And it's fun to do. And Gary, it has helped me so much when I do my writing classes, workshops for faculty, students, all of that. I start with the Heaven and Earth design piece. And I show them and I say, how do you go from this? When I show them my little beginnings on this piece I'm working on, like maybe 200 stitches on the thing, which is nothing and it looks nothing like nothing. I say, how do you go from that to this? And then I flash a picture on the screen of the painting, the artwork that I am doing, and their jaws drop, you know. And I say, well, the way you go from there to here is one stitch and next to another stitch, next to another stitch. And so the same principle applies, except that you have to have a system. And the same principle applies for writing. Writing is just one word after another word, and it's better if you have a system for it. That's it. So I use my Heaven and Earth design piece, which I will probably not finish. I'll probably die before I finish that one. But I use it. It's a great metaphor for my teaching.
Yeah. Oh, I get, that's a perfect tie-in. Perfect. So yeah. Do you do the parking thing? 'Cause I have to say, yeah. Heaven and Earth people, I have the utmost respect for, especially when they finish them. Like, whoa, because yeah. that's a long haul across those things. And yes. you do the whole parking thing too?
Yeah, well, that's what I learned with YouTube. So until I started watching FlossTube, I had no idea how to tackle one of these. And it was so daunting, the idea of you know, you do one stitch in one color and then another stitch in another color and then change it again to another color. I'm going, how do you do that? It just seems like crazy and can't do it. But then I was watching Brian on Blitz Stitch, and he said, you know, all you need is a system. And I'm going, oh, I get that. Because for writing is the same thing. You need a system.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started learning the system strategies, one of them, parking or cross country. And I've tried both. I do better in this big piece. I do better with parking and doing 10 by 10 squares and parking. But sometimes I get tired of it. The confetti is crazy. You have squares of 10 by 10 stitches, 100 stitches, where you have 60 different colors in there.
Oh.
it's just, you know. But then the effect, oh my goodness, the effect later is just so, yeah. I learned so much with the folks in FlossTube. And I learned by looking at what they were teaching and the strategies they used. And I've been trying different things and see what works for me.
So with that, oh, I can't even imagine that many colors in a square like that. But but so you almost absolutely have to have a grid.
Yes.
To keep organized.
Oh, absolutely. That was another thing I learned, right? Was to either grid my fabric or buy a pre-gridded fabric. So the one I'm using for my Heaven and Earth is pre-gridded. If it weren't, I just make too many mistakes, Gary. I make so many mistakes. It's ridiculous. Yeah. Sometimes I go, this isn't normal. The number of mistakes I make is not normal. But yeah.
Well, hey, that's it's a great tie into your teaching too. Yeah.
Oh, it has served me very, very well. And actually then I get some of my graduate students sometimes interested in learning the stitching, you know, or learning something related to needle arts or reviving some of their old interests in that. And I always say, you know, the best way to keep yourself sane during graduate school is to have a hobby like this. So.
Yeah, see, and that's something that I did not have in school, and I've often thought that I would have been better off, because it was late in school when I got introduced to needlepoint,
mm-hmm.
and as a male, of course, you just didn't do that around other guys, you know. So, but I often thought that, you know, now that I'm better aware of things. Back then, it would have been nice to have. I'd have probably been more effective at studying if I'd have had some kind of hobby to just take my mind away from it.
Yeah, and it's you think it's taking your mind away from it, but while you're, at least for me, while I'm stitching or doing any kind of needlework, my subconscious is actually working on mm-hmm. my work, on my writing, on my research. And when I get back to it, it's more mature, it's different. Or I get unstuck on something I was stuck before. It's almost the same benefits as sleeping in a way.
Oh yeah. No. And see, with my bike riding, you know, many times, you know, I'm trying to sort something out. It just won't come to me. And my wife has even said, you need a bike ride on that one. And get out there and physically drain yourself. And yeah, the mind starts to be more effective. Yep.
And people have this wrong impression that if they're going to dedicate themselves to a hobby on the side while they're going to graduate school, for instance, that they have to have lots of large chunks of time. And I go, no, all you need is to do it for 5 or 10 minutes in between something, just to rest. And if you can do that just for 5 to 10, don't neglect the benefit of 5, 10 minutes of working on something that refreshes your mind. It is such an investment. And I don't know if you read, there's a little book called The Kaizen Principle or something like that, which is Japanese for small.
Yes.
I never underestimate the value of tiny little bits of time or tiny little steps that we take. They make such a difference in the end if we stay with them.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and that gets back to throw in a couple stitches every so often during the day, and you'd be amazed what gets done. Yes.
You will be amazed. You will always go, when did I do that?
All right, lace making. I got to hear about lace making because the bobbin lace, watching Arlene in particular, how do you get, because you have what, a couple types of lace that you do. How do you get involved in that? And
well, I've always
how do you keep track of all those spindles?
Well, that's a problem. I always loved lace. And even when I did, and I do still crochet, I don't like the big rustic yarn-based crochet pieces. I don't like to work on those. I like the really thin, like right now, my next challenge is to learn micro crochet. Have you heard of that?
No.
Okay.
I'm not surprised it exists, but no.
It does. And micro crochet is crochet that's done with sewing thread.
No.
Yes. So it's hard to even find the hooks for that. You have to order them from Japan because they're hard to come by. They have to be so thin. They're so thin that they are spiky. I mean, they're sharp as a needle.
Uh-huh.
Also. So that's my next challenge is to do that. So I've always loved lace, but I never thought, and in Brazil, lace making, especially in the northeast part of Brazil, I lived in the southeast part. The northeast part is known for lace making, women making lace in the streets. And I don't know if you remember the Olympics in Brazil, in the closing ceremony, they did homage to the lace makers in Brazil. It was very beautiful at the end.
Oh,
in the closing.
Missed that one. Yeah.
Yeah, it was really, really beautiful, really cool. And so I'm a sucker for lace. Anything that has lace catches my attention. And so I started watching Arlene's Floss Tube videos, and I watched her from the very first one and was so intrigued that she did bobbin lace. And I'm going, I can learn this. There's got to be a way I can learn this. And at the time, I had a friend who would come over to my house and stitch. We would do that once a month. And I would share with her all the things I was hearing on FlossTube and seeing, and I was so enamored by the lace possibility. She went, and without me knowing, she ordered a starter set of bobbin bobbins, the bobbin the lace making pillow and threads, and sent it to me as a gift. And I'm going, okay, now I got to start something, right? I can't just talk about it anymore.
Yeah, yeah, the waffling is over. Yes.
So I did, and I just, again, self-taught. So I'm learning through YouTube videos, asked Arlene a couple of things, and that's how I started contacting Arlene, was actually about the bobbin lace. I wanted her opinion on whether, where I could go to learn, was it worth investing in it, and we started an email conversation over that. That's how we started connecting. Oh. So we've never, but we've talked a lot about that. And I love the bobbin lace. Oh, Gary, it's such fun to do. And it came to me. I was so surprised when I was learning. I'm still learning. I'm still such a beginner. But I was very surprised how intuitive it was for me. It felt like I had been doing this in a previous life or something, which I don't believe in previous lives. But it's like, it felt like, oh, I've done this before. It just seems so logical to me. Hmm. And it's a lot of fun. Now, I do not like the idea of having 200 bobbins to work with on a single project. So I learned that I can learn something called tape laces or different types of tape lace that only involve like maximum 12 pairs of bobbins. And I'm going, okay, 12 pairs I can manage. But 200 pairs or even 200 bobbins, 100 pairs, it's too much.
So now, when you start bobbin lace one, how many bobbins do you have? Just three or four? I guess it always has to be even numbers, right? So,
well,
how does that start?
It starts with even numbers, but if you're going, it usually starts with learning some of the basic stitches, and just to practice those, you might need four to six pairs. But the kit that I got came with 12 pairs already.
Mm-hmm.
And very, very quickly, it went from 4 to 12 to 24.
Yeah.
It keeps growing. If you want to do anything a little bit more complicated, it requires more bobbins. And so I'm going, nah, I really like this, but I do not want to have this nightmare thing of hundreds. We're talking hundreds of bobbins. But then I thought, oh, there's this thing called Russian lace, Russian bobbin lace. And it's a tape lace, and it uses basically maybe 24 bobbins or so. There are types of lace that you can do with very limited number or smaller number of bobbins. And that's what I'm going to go for. But I'm still learning, Gary. Very, very beginning.
Okay. So, but if we talk about 12 bobbins, you're really just dealing with 6 units then.
Correct.
So, but, see, that helps me right there, because that gets it down to, all right, I've just got to address 6 units of whatever to make this work.
But if you look at Arlene's videos on that, she talks about it too. You only work with 4 at a time, or 2 pairs at a time.
Mm-hmm.
So you're at any given time, it doesn't matter how complex it is, what you're doing, you're only handling 2 bobbins on one hand and 2 bobbins on the other hand.
So all the rest of it really mentally just is set aside, and that you just work on that. Okay.
Yes.
See, that makes it more approachable, because I've actually sat at a table with Arlene and watched her go, and it's mesmerizing, number one, but the first thing comes to my mind and stays is, how do you keep track of all that? So if it only is 2 sets, then anybody can keep track of that.
Yeah. You keep track of that by the outcome, but by what is resulting. So you look at what you've done and you say, okay, this stitch is complete. So now I need to work with these 2 pairs over here and complete. So that's how it guides. But Arlene is very fast. She does it. I'm nowhere near her speed. And Arlene does what's called the palms down method. If you notice how her hands are placed on the pillow, sometimes I'll do the palms down, but I like the palms up, where you're actually holding the bobbins. Okay. I like the feel of the bobbins in my hand and that little noise where they click against each other. It's awesome.
Yeah. There's a therapy that goes on there, I'm quite sure. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
The sounds of...
We're going to run out of time, and I got to talk to me about your cross stitching, because we've done all this and haven't talked about cross stitching. So, is that primarily what you do?
Not primarily. It's one of the, I would say what I do more frequently, just because of the ease of carrying it around, is the crochet.
Okay.
And I have a crochet project everywhere I go, and tatting also, but tatting is a little bit more difficult if you make a mistake. So I take it on trips, for instance, in airplanes. I'll take the tatting, but I can't do it just 1 minute here, 1 minute there, because if you make a mistake in tatting is a bunch of knots. And if you make a mistake, it's like undoing a bunch of knots. Imagine shoestring knots, that you have to undo one at a time. Crochet, you just pull the working thread and it's done. You've erased everything you've done. You can start over again. But so I would say primary in terms of frequency would be crochet, but primary in terms of investment, thanks to the new stand that's coming in, for which you have no responsibility whatsoever, is...
You're welcome.
It's the cross stitch, yes. A cross stitch and hardanger, yeah.
Uh-huh, okay. Do you do mostly small cross stitch, or is it a mixture?
I'm doing a little bit bigger pieces now. The Heaven and Earth design is one.
Yeah, that would classify as bigger, yeah.
So the piece I did for Arlene on her design, I would consider that a small right now.
Okay.
And that was what? 6x7x6? It should have come out square, and it didn't. That was my first stitching in linen. I had never stitched in linen at all. And it was my first attempt, and I didn't realize the linen wasn't perfectly even. So it didn't come out perfectly square.
Oh, you got a piece that the warp and the weft weren't the same.
Correct.
Oh, ouch.
Well, it turned out good. Still.
So talk to me about that, because for so many people, that's a leap to go from Aida to linen. And some people never make that leap. And I've never understood why it matters. And I think part of that is my needlepoint background, where it's just how big are the holes.
Right.
So I don't give it any thought. But for so many, it's a major leap of faith and just stitching prowess that makes it freaks some people out. So was it a big deal to you?
It was, because I had never done it before, and I was intimidated by the small holes and the ability to see it. So until I started watching FlossTube, I did most of my cross stitching in hand, and it's much easier to do in hand when you're doing it on Aida, mm-hmm. I think. And so I tried linen once. It didn't work out well. When I started watching FlossTube and I started seeing everybody using some kind of a frame or something to keep it stretched, I thought, if I have that, maybe I can try it. And the combination of having it on a Q-snap or some kind of a frame or hoop, and having the magnifying lens with the lights, those two, I looked at it and I thought, what's the big deal? There's no big deal here.
Okay.
But only at that moment was I able to say that.
Okay, so a couple little aids, and then it was the problem went away.
And it's actually interesting now, because I will alternate. I'll stitch on Aida and stitch on Even Weave with my Heaven and Earth design. And then once in a while I go, oh, I am just itching to stitch on linen. I miss that linen stitching, because it does look different. It feels different. It looks so much nicer on linen, I think. But I miss it. It's so funny that I'm hooked on linen, and I want to try the 40 count that you have mentioned you like. And I'm going, oh my gosh, can I do the 40 count? I guess I can, if I have the magnifier and the lights and everything.
To me, the count is a moot point because of the magnifier and the light.
Yes.
It just really doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. And, I'm sure I have a magnifier light set up similar to yours. And when the cloth is underneath it, you know, those holes in the threads are gigantic. And
exactly. Yeah. Yep.
You can see exactly what's going on. Yeah. I don't give it a thought. And I do like the 40 count look. I mean, it really is a nice look.
But it took learning about, you know, you need to stretch it, you need to have the tension, whatever, all of those little details about the technique. And having the magnifier and the light, it took learning about that first to then say, okay, let me try. And when I tried it, the first piece was Arlene's piece. And I'm going, oh, this is, what's, what, why did I wait so long?
Yeah. The people who impress me are the people who can count stitch on 36 and 40 count in hand without magnifiers.
Yeah, are there any people like that?
Yes, there are. And I have no idea how they do it.
Are they 12 years old?
Yeah, exactly. No, they're younger. There's no doubt about that. Yeah. But to me, that's impressive because I think there's a, just in watching some of the FlossTube, and I think at some point there's a feel that they're dragging the needle. I think there's an element of dragging the needle and counting. And I may be completely loopy on this, but I think I see some of that, a subconscious, I can see it, and I can see it well enough, but there's a little drag of the needle, and that gets, you know, you can feel the fall into the hole, and the next one, that's where it goes. And maybe I'm nuts, but I have a sense that for some, at least, there's some of that that goes on that helps them do it. You know, whatever. I mean, there's, you know, whatever technique works, but...
Yeah, and you know, they feel different, both of them. And some pieces look, I think, not all of them, but some pieces do look better in linen, but not all. And I still stitch on Aida. I still like Aida. But I tend to go now with Aida on 18 count minimum, because I like the smaller stitches better. It's just different feels, different techniques, different tools, different things for different projects. I think each project has its own best place where it's situated, either linen, Aida, or whatever. It just, I like them all, actually. But, and I was so happy when I did the linen, and I thought, it's not a big deal. I can do it.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good statement there, is that it's whatever is appropriate, because Vanna, with her Jesus project, certainly demonstrated how beautiful a piece can be on Ada. And,
oh, yeah.
And people who slam Ada and say, oh, no, that's a beginner cloth or whatever. And that Jesus project is, I mean, I'll hold that up any day and say, nah, I'm not buying that beginner cloth stuff. That, you know, look at this piece right here. And and tell me that it's better or, it's not. It's perfect. So,
yeah, I agree with you. And for certain projects I've done, Ada looks best. There's no doubt about it. Mm-hmm. So, linen is not always the best thing. It just has different feels. Just like driving different cars, I guess, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yep. Pat, we got to stop.
Oh, wow.
See how this happens.
I do.
Really have enjoyed it. Thanks for taking the time. This has been fun.
Well, thank you very much. And I hope you try the standing up stitching situation and let us know how it went.
Oh, you don't have to hope. It's happening.
Okay.
Yeah, it's happening. All right, Pat, thanks so much for doing this. And thanks to everybody for listening. And thanks once again to Fat Quarter Shop for sponsoring this week's podcast. Be sure to visit them soon, and please mention that you heard about them from Fiber Talk. Their website, once again, fatquartershop.com.